This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
We shall give you sa un bongo. The speediest way to the Naboo is going through the planet core. Go.
There's a second you set up. Going through the planet core? That's bombing.
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we have guests. I focused on the guests. We're doing The Phantom Menace. The Phantom Menace is what we're doing. We're looking at episode one. Yeah. As always, I don't think we have any news and we want to introduce our guests properly first, so we won't do news this week. We'll introduce our guests. We'll tell you a little bit about the movie, our thoughts, and, then we'll get stuck into the science that I want to say science, but I mean, the Jedis are supposed to be like magical, right?
Yeah.
Religious?
Mm-hmm. Space magic.
Okay. Yes, but there is some genuinely cool biology, as there is in every kind of Star Wars film. So as always, the show's broke up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below, so skip ahead to whatever you're most interested in. But before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater / invasive ecologist. I got my PhD at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I also run the website eEcology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsick, and this is the last time I'll be able to say this, a PhD candidate at the University of Arkansas. It'll be the day after, right? Like the day after this comes out on Thursday, you'll be defending?
Yes. If you're listening to this, as soon as it comes out, I will be defending in about 24 hours.
Final day dawns.
Through thoughts, prayers, good luck stuffs. Alongside Adam, as always, is Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as every week, we're joined by Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. Also joining us today, we wanted to look at some of the cool... Look, Star Wars always has really cool underwater... not underwater, really cool beasties and really cool biology. But this movie, right from the start, it's got some of the coolest like underwater creatures I've ever seen in movies. So we thought we should get some underwater experts to come on, people who have lived most of their lives underwater.
Yeah. Rains a lot.
Fish experts, or as they are called on their pod, the movie aficionados, Danielle Crowley and Aoife Hugh... No, fuck's sake.
Kearns.
That works.
Aoife,
for fuck's sake. That's her full name.
Aoife, fuck's sake.
Danielle Crowley and Aoife, for fuck's sake, Hugh Cairns. There yes. We go. Got it all out in one.
Nice.
Hello. Now, normally, if we had somebody on, I would ask them to describe their podcast, and we will probably do that later on as well. But for starters, I think the perfect introduction to your podcast is for you two to describe why it's okay to eat James McAvoy at ease.
Mostly, I think he'd be up for it, is the thing.
Probably.
he strikes me as a weirdo.
I think we would also be up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a snack.
Yeah. What's that thing you say, like, James McAvoy, if you're free on Thursday? I'm free on Thursday.
No, free on Good Friday.
On Good Friday. Yeah.
But our in-podcast explanation is that he's technically also a fish.
Yeah. Because our great grand-uncle, the coelacanths, had a brother who became our great-great-great-great-granddads, and those were fishes, so we're technically all lobe-finned fishes. So cannibalism is permissible on Good Friday and Ash Wednesday.
Just ask Army Hammer.
Yeah.
Is this one of those rules where it's like, there's nothing in the rule book that says a dog can't play basketball? Yeah. Like, there's nothing in the rule book that says...
Which is
like,
strange, because there is stuff in the rule book that says a baby rabbit is a fish and you can't eat it on fast days. So it's a weird rule book.
Well, I was going to ask, is it safe to say that James McAvoy is a goldfish because he's the snack that smiles back?
I like your style.
I'm quitting the pod.
Do you want to just briefly describe what the movie Aficionados Pod is about?
Basically, we rate movies based on what fish are in them, how long they're on screen, whether they're being kept in good conditions, and just how cool they are in general.
Yeah. So this podcast is the natural result of what happens when you trap two 20-somethings in a house in South Dublin for the most of a year. It's exactly what it says on the tin. I think it's a very straightforward idea. We rate movies by the most important thing. Are there fish on screen? And are those fish cherished?
Speaking of poorly nourished fish, I did listen to the Skeleton Twins episode this morning. That was a
harrowing. Yeah, it's a great movie.
Very good, but the poor fish.
The poor fish. And humans. But
but I think it's the first one you've done that had a fish death count, yeah. Right?
No, we did
fish called Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's the one with Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's the one all of our extremely apparently sadistic friends and family told us immediately we had to cover for the podcast as soon as they found out the podcast was happening. But yeah, Movie Aficionados got Danny, who knows about fish, and me, who doesn't. So
when I watched A Fish Called Wanda, I was just a huge Monty Python fan, and we saw this movie and we're like, oh, that's lots of the Monty Python people. And I was like, you know, 9 at the time. I didn't know what an orgasm was. So whenever, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis was going nuts, I was just like, what's happening?
What is this movie?
It's a weird one.
I heard moaning. I was worried.
I was faking it, you stupid jerk.
Don't ever call me stupid. And I'm not jealous.
Then leave.
Okay. It's a nice place. Don't touch his dick.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, we all watched The Phantom Menace this week. Who wants to start?
I can do it.
May I?
Oh, yeah. Please, Eva.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yes. Somebody needs to summarize this movie for us before we
let's hear it, Eva.
What we think of it.
I will summarize it according to my priorities and interests. So
not biased at all.
So it appears to be a Little Rascals race sequence wrapped in an attempt at political intrigue featuring Rent Boy from Trainspotting, who is visibly holding back the urge to exclaim, holy shit, I'm in a Star Wars at any time. He seems to be in love with Liam Neeson and they're both wearing Snuggies. There's a small child. There's a space Shylock and some very bad anti-Semitism, a lot of Orientalism, some really kick-ass outfits, and most importantly, two droids fall in love.
Aw, and don't forget Liam Neeson wanting to kill himself for being around other horrible actors, and he's the only one that's acting good.
Yeah.
Every scene, he's just, like, seething through the tea.
Yeah. We were playing a one-hour-long version of Daft Punk's harder, whatever, at
harder,
the end.
Better, faster, stronger.
Yeah, at the end over all the fight sequences, because they were impossible to pay attention to without that. But it worked real well.
But the Duel of the Fates is awesome.
Yeah, but Adam, see, you said that to me, and I think, Danny, you mentioned Duel of the Fates as well, but by the time it got to that point of the film, I was playing FIFA at the same time. Like, I just...
We paused the film at one point, went to YouTube, put on Weird Al's The Saga Begins, watched the entirety of that, and then started watching the movie again.
I felt like that was actually a very clarifying tool to understand what was happening.
It really is. That song actually breaks down the plot super well.
Apparently it was released before the movie came out, based on fan theories.
It was.
I've tried really hard this year to be, like, kind of less critical, less just enjoy a movie for a movie, which, you know... Yeah, well, I mean, that obviously led to me, you know, loving Godzilla vs. Kong, much to Adam's chagrin.
So we see that this was a problem.
But I could not deal with this. Like, it was just... It wasn't that it was bad. It was just... It was so boring.
I think my biggest problem on a rewatch was that they kept throwing in these political intrigue terms, and they kept having, like, there's the Galactic Trade Federation, which we assume is a mix of Amazon and the East India Trading Company, but we're not given any context. And then in Naboo, they keep saying that people are starving and dying, and they're being put in camps. But we never see any of that.
No. Nope.
And we've, like, there's no kind of stake. We're just being told things are happening with no context.
But we do see a little boy racing a little car really fast.
Mario Kart in space.
Hell yeah.
That part was so fun.
I feel really bad for Jake Lloyd because he was bullied mercilessly for years because of this. Yeah. Like, he's got paranoid schizophrenia these days. He's submitted himself to psychiatric care and that sort of stuff. He went through a lot of shit. And look, he's not a good actor in this movie.
But he's a child.
Yeah, he's a child, yeah.
Also, that is what I was like when I was 9, so it may not be bad acting, to be fair. Just a shithead kid.
However, Hayden Christensen, he was older. Mm-hmm. He could take it. But Jake Lloyd was 10 years old, like, in high school and the media, and he got so much hate mail from
and
people.
And was
like,
it Ahmed Best as well, who was Jar Jar?
Yeah.
Got death threats and all a bunch of horrible
killed
stuff.
His career.
Oh, yeah. My summary completely omitted Jar Jar, like I wish the movie had.
Oh, they meet him so early, too. You're like 15 minutes in and he pops up. My God.
There's no respite. Anytime there's a little bit of a downtime, they're like, what if they had Jar Jar just fuck up the scene for no purpose?
I have an embarrassing story about this sort of thing. I watched, Adam and I, we both went and rewatched all the Star Wars films before A Force Awakens before The Force Awakened, we went and watched all these Star Wars movies. And before that, for about 10 years, anytime something like weird had happened or like overwhelming had happened, I'd go, and I never knew where I got it from. And then I watched that fucking movie and I was like, I've been aping Jar Jar Binks for the last 10 years. My God.
Holy shit. I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was really, really embarrassing.
I'm so sorry. It's a terrible thing to discover in yourself.
God.
So were all the people in his life.
I will say, back to the political discussion, I do feel like the term from Darth Sidious where he's standing there and he's like, I don't think you need to be concerned about the actions. I've got the ambassador bogged down in Senate discussions. And I'm like, that sounded way more menacing in George Lucas's head, didn't it?
Yeah. I was just saying, George Lucas wrote this having no, like, knowledge of how politics works, I think.
I think George Lucas should have, like, been a DM or something, because he created a world and he did not create a plot to go in it.
DM is Dungeon Master,
Dungeon
right?
Master, yes. Mm-hmm. And like any good Dungeon Master, he based his story off of a love of another story, that being Flash Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also old samurai films. Yeah. He brought in a whole bunch of other stuff that he borrowed from and stole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, the same films, reason that we all love, like, the first Zack Snyder film, 300, where he just copied the comic book storyline of a better writer, and we were like, oh, that was a lot of fun. And then he was like, maybe I'll start writing. And it was like, no, don't do that.
Or it's kind of like Stephen Moffat with Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Let's not open that can.
I loved him for the first 2 years of everything he did, and then after that, it just, yeah. But, so, Senator Palpatine being Darth Sidious, was that supposed to not be obvious?
That's a very good question.
I don't know, because it is very obvious.
Yeah! Even as an 11-year-old, I was like, that's clearly
like
the bad
he shows
guy.
Up and he's so clearly evil from the first second he's there.
Where you can recognize him and under the hood.
Yeah.
It's like just his forehead is covered.
You can see his facial structure. Terrence Stamp is in this. What? I had no memory of him being in this. Like, was he still considered an actor of caliber when this came out?
I think, as obvious as it was that Palpatine was evil, I think rewatching this movie for this podcast kind of took me on a journey from seeing this movie as a kid, enjoying it quite a bit, because I was a kid and it's a Star Wars movie, fuck yeah, to up until about the time I rewatched it before The Force Awakens, as Sam was talking about, I was like, you know, they're not great movies, but it's more of that universe, and I really appreciate that. Rewatching them then, before The Force Awakens, I'm like, no, these are absolutely fucking awful, I cannot enjoy these. But then watching it this last week, and be like, you know, I really appreciate what this movie was trying to be. Mm-hmm. And if you think about what it could have been, I really enjoy it. And also, the whole, like, seeing all the machinations of how Palpatine pulled these strings, like, from the very beginning was really cool to kind of think about, like, how he orchestrated fucking everything to make sure he got to power. And I really enjoyed that.
And it told a consistent story.
Yeah. I had not seen this movie since theaters. So this was my first rewatch since I was 11 years old. I remember hating it as an 11-year-old. which is kind of funny because that was its target demographic, I think. Yeah. And I think Adam actually helped me enjoy it a lot more because I'm not a big Star Wars fan. You know, I know you're going to burn me at the cross for saying that. I was more of a Trekkie growing up. And Adam actually explained to me a fan theory, which I'd never heard before, about Darth Jar Jar.
That made the movie
so much better because I could tolerate him.
Yeah. I prefer to think of him as malicious. Yeah.
He climbs his way up from thrown away in the swamp, kicked out, all the way up to senator status. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I think he got kicked out for war crimes. The whole, like, clumsiness was a cover.
That's what I was picturing, too. Like, he was trying to, like, sell out his people or something.
His dark machinations did not go unpunished. Mm-hmm. But then he went and he brooded and he became stronger.
Please, Eva, his Darth machinations.
That puts, like, a new spin on, like, because when he gets to the Underwater City... everybody starts looking at him and they're all just really silent. And the implication is, oh, not this fuck up back. But maybe they're all just terrified.
Mm-hmm. Oh god, Hitler's back.
We kicked him into the swamp. We thought that was done.
I think the Rise of Skywalker would have been better if, towards the beginning, you had Oscar Isaac go, somehow, Darth Jar Jar has returned.
I mean, going back to Jar Jar, I think my favorite thing is whenever a new Star Wars poster comes out, within 2 minutes, somebody has photoshopped all the faces in that poster to be Jar Jar, and it's amazing every single time.
Another cool thing Danny pointed out, I think, is that the prequels just try to do so, so much, but what they would have really excelled as is like a mini-series. If they were being made like now, and you could like actually explore what any of what you're saying means, it could have been really good because there's clearly like a lot of world to cover and they're not able to.
The Clone Wars TV show does that, and it does it fantastically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why everyone likes it more.
I will not allow that.
What will you do? If you shoot me, you prove yourself a hypocrite to every pacifist ideal you hold dear. And you, Kenobi, you are no stranger to violence. You'd be hailed as a hero by everyone on this ship. Almost everyone. Come on, then. Who will strike first and brand themselves a cold-blooded killer?
Anakin.
What? He was gonna blow up the ship.
Okay, so we are obviously talking about the Star Wars universe today. Now, regardless of what you think of the movies, I think Star Wars has some of the best speculative biology in any movie series or any movie ever. I think the creatures look so cool. For the most part, they're semi-realistic, I think. Like, the flying creatures are all, like, reasonable size. I think the one that I've ever watched and thought that's ridiculous was the giant space worm in the meteor.
Oh, yeah.
But apart from that, like, they just look so damn cool. So, as opposed to an entire podcast where we just talk about how cool Star Wars biology is, because I think we could fill at least, you know, like, 3 episodes with that sort of stuff. What I thought we'd do is just to get everybody to run through their favorite Star Wars animal. And Dave, you are first on my screen, so you get started.
I love the Wookiees, man. I started with the Wookiees. I started with Chewbacca. That was my favorite part of the prequel series where we actually got to go back to Kashyyyk. I had the Clone Wars video games, and that was like the only level I loved playing was trying to defend the Wookiees. They will always be my species of choice.
Danny, you're next.
Oh man, this is really hard. I remember when I was a kid, I really loved, it was only there really briefly, but you know the giant iguana thing that Obi-Wan rides in Revenge of the Sith? I thought that was the coolest thing ever. I think the Tauntauns are fun. Like, I think it's just because they're practical effects, like they just sit into the universe in a way that they just feel solid and they feel like they're meant to be there. But I also like, I like when they bring in more of the like mystical force elements. So I think they did that really well with the wolves in Rebels and also that snake at the end of Rise of Skywalker. I like that blending of the biology and also that like there's mystical shit going on as well. So that would be me.
By the way, if you have never seen comedian Bill Hader do an impression of a tauntaun.
I have, yeah.
It's fantastic.
My favorite bit of that is when he just keels over on stage.
My favorite Star Wars creature is the weird cross between a horse and a T-Rex and a potato that the Mandalorian bonds with in a horse girl movie way at the very first episode of The Mandalorian.
Oh yeah.
Where he just has this sequence.
What was that thing called?
I think it's the Blurg. Yeah. So that's my first answer. My second answer is a horse. Because there's also horses.
This film we're looking at today, there are just straight up geese in it.
Yeah.
They mention ducks. They say sitting ducks.
Yeah. Ducks exist in the Star Wars universe, at least metaphorically.
Well, obviously falcons do as well. Like, otherwise, what are they naming that thing after?
Mm-hmm.
Adam?
I think for me, it's as a kid, it was always the Dewback, which is those big lizards they ride on Tatooine. The Stormtroopers ride them. I had a toy, and it was really cool.
Mm.
But ever since the prequels, the Acklay, that lizard spider thing that Obi-Wan fights in the pit on Geonosis.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That thing was so badass.
Libby?
Elibizeth?
Yes. Mine would be the Wampa, because in Star Wars Battlefront 2, you get to play as the Wampa and absolutely maul the shit out of some people, and it is fantastic.
Mine is one of the ones we're covering today. It's the Sandow Aqua Monster, the massive one, like the really huge one. I was obsessed with like massive creatures.
The Gila Monster?
Yeah, the thing that looks like a Gila Monster, yeah. Just seeing that the first time I watched this movie.
It is really cool.
It is so cool, though. Like, it's just so fucking big, and it just looks so awesome.
And it goes,
Thank you for that impression.
Oh, speaking of weird sounds. Okay, so, Adam, you know how I was saying I turned my brain off for Godzilla versus Kong? I missed... My brain was already off by this point, but I missed the bit where Godzilla laughs.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen this yet?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So fucking stupid.
That was a bridge too far, even for, like... Yeah.
Someone said the entire movie was a bridge too far. See our discussion last week.
Adam really hasn't let that wound heal, has he? Just keeps picking at it.
He's been talking about it all week.
With a title like Godzilla vs. Kong, they better deliver on the fights as they pit the titular titans against each other no less than three times. I mean, sure, Godzilla wins 2 out of 3 because, I mean, come on, look at the guy. And yes, Kong spends more time on his back than Riley Reid. But the film will do everything in its power to make you root for the big hairy boy.
Before we get into the movie side, this section's going to go on for a long time.
It's a whole podcast on introductions.
Right, okay, so before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions for us, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Sam Perrin, NTNU. Adam is at... No, I'm... Oh, I've got a new Twitter name now. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy.
Of course.
Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit... you can visit us on Twitter as well, at @C_Animalia. You can check out the website, www.cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to get in touch with Danny or Aoife, you can find them on Twitter at @aqua_dan1, or at, I'm going to spell it, okay?
Yeah, go for it.
at @AIFEKEARNSMCH, or at @FishMoviePod. If you want to read Libby's work, visit www.shortstorysoup@substack.com. You can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And also, if you do want to hear some of Libby's work, you can check out Tales to Terrify, the podcast, which this week featured Libby's first published story, right?
Yeah, episode 480.
Yeah.
480, yeah. The story is called The Catch,
yes,
I believe.
Is.
That's what I like to call Libby.
Fish-themed.
It's definitely not what they call Sam.
We let him go.
That's a bycatch, actually.
Yes. Trash fish, yeah.
The unwanted material is called the bycatch.
Okay, and the bycatch, yeah, there we go. Yeah. Now, if you want to read about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can also check out ecologyforthemasses.com. We got through it eventually.
Hey guys, it's just Dave the Vet cutting in for a quick second. We got a little bit carried away in this episode, and I realized we really hadn't done our introduction or kind of our focus points for just letting you guys know where we're hoping to go. So for this episode, thanks to our aficionado guests, we opted to focus on Naboo, the water planet that we start the beginning of the film with, the home of Queen Amidala. Specifically on Naboo, we wanted to talk about the underwater transition, so when Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan find Jar Jar Binks, and then end up making their transition underwater to the Gungan city, and then finally taking the ship through the core, quote-unquote, and we'll talk about that, of the planet, where they're able to find three different monsters. And the monsters that we're going to be focusing on are the OPD Killer. That's a large crustacean-like creature they run into at the beginning with the long tongue and the big claws that very shortly after gets eaten by the Sando Aqua Monster, the large, gray, enormous, muscular predator, the one that appears to be absolutely huge with the very odd teeth that eats the Sea Killer. And then the last monster we were going to focus on was the Kolo Clawfish. Now, that's the large, sort of tentacled, almost eel-like thing that has the large jaw with almost the little appendages off to the side of the face that they used to eat with, that also gets eaten by the Sando Aqua Monster. Now, the last species we'll be kind of doing a little bit of a focus on is the Gungans. They are tall, bipedal organisms with long stalked eyes coming off the top of their head, the sort of extendable tongue and the kind of thickened skin, as well as just kind of talking about the planet as a whole in terms of aquatic development. And then the last thing that our guests will be kind of running us through is something called the Star Wars Field Guide, which is a book that we'd sort of looked at beforehand that's been written sort of from a biologist's perspective on the planet to give us more information on these three creatures, as well as the underwater world that makes up Naboo. If you're listening and you're saying, I don't know where they're getting this information, or what do you mean they're talking about it's an evolved trait? Usually we're referencing the Star Wars Field Guide. I hope that makes everything clear going forward, and I'll get back to the episode. Thanks, guys.
Okay, so the first question we kind of wanted to look at today is a Star Wars fish the same as an Earth fish? Because it is very heavily implied that these three enormous creatures we see in what is a really cool underwater sequence are all fish, when they are yes. Maybe the first one looks kind of fishy.
With arthropod legs.
But with arthropod legs. I think it looks like a crustacean,
I do like
really.
How the field guide just seemed to, like the Star Wars field guide kind of gave some sort of a class to most things, and this one it just gave up. It was like, it's part fish, it's part crustacean, don't worry about it.
What we don't know. Don't look into it.
What are woodlice?
They're
arthropods.
Arthropods. Yeah. So that's what they're reminding me of most. Because I know arthropods are weird, and they seem crustacean-y, but they're not. So if I was being extremely generous, I'd be like, this is some kind of a water louse-ish.
When a wood louse and a fish love each other very much.
Yeah. And the force helps them.
I think this planet was like first like invaded or colonized by people who were from like a desert planet, and they'd seen like one species of fish in their life, and they saw things that like moved underwater. They're like, they are all fish, and we are going to call them fish. And they, biology just hasn't moved on.
You mean like on our Earth?
You're in the water. You have to be a fish.
Yeah. Well, I think most five-year-olds these days know that whales aren't fish. Although, maybe they are.
Do they?
I don't know. My five-year-old did, but that might just be because I yelled at him whenever he saw it. Oh, look, it's a fish. I'm like, no, it's fucking not. No.
Convergent evolution, my dude.
I mean, we don't even know whether the Star Wars humans are mammals.
That is interesting, yeah.
We can assume, but do we know?
He called him a human. They used the word human in that movie.
Do they?
But what if that's translation, an attempt at localization in this documentary for human consumption?
That's a really good point. I think one of my favorite theories about this is because, you know, this is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And one of the dumbest fan theories I've heard is like, what if these are all, you know, humans, but they're all 100 feet tall? Like, we don't know that this is not just like a gigantic universe.
I love it.
So, yeah, we agree that this is just convergent evolution. None of them are actually fish, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think that they can be a fish.
Some of them could. Yeah. I mean, the
like, what is a fish?
The second one could, the coloclon fish could be a
doesn't
fish.
Doesn't that look more reptilian?
Maybe.
It looks kind of like a seahorse, which is a fish, so...
I think if anything, it's a polychaete, so it's a giant worm. Mm. It's a jawed worm that has the segmented jaws.
I think it's just like a gharial that's evolved for life, you know, a much more aquatic life.
Yeah, maybe.
Gharial? Gharial?
Gharial.
I mean, it could be anything. Yeah. I thought it looked reptilian, but I do like the George Lucas theory. The jawed worm theory. Yes. But polychaetes are mainly parasites, aren't they?
No.
No.
Not mainly.
No? Okay.
Plenty of them are predatory.
It's been a long time.
What if it's related to, bobbit worms?
Oh, those are the ones that like, they hide in the sand and they like grab fish like five times their size, right?
It looks like the worm from Dune, but in water.
Hmm. Not much has changed, but we live underwater.
Going back to the One Direction.
No, honey, no.
Isn't that from them? Isn't that one of their lyrics?
No.
Busted.
Busted, yeah. Later covered by the Jonas Brothers.
Yeah, sorry. We
are so far out of my wheelhouse right now. I don't even know what language you guys are speaking.
He didn't even have a wheelhouse. He moved.
Yes!
He doesn't even have a wheelhouse.
Very efficient at generating power, though. Okay, the thing they bring up in this movie is that there's, like, lakes and underwater caverns going through the core of the planet.
I mean, I think that's just a colloquial thing. They call it the planet's core, and unless you're going to live in some stupid universe like the Godzilla vs. Kong universe where they actually have a planet core, you can't have this.
No.
It just doesn't work.
No, they're traveling through some big stone corridor caverny area that just gets them to Naboo slightly faster. And later on, like, you see them flying their spaceships back and forth between, like, the Naboo's areas and the Gungans' areas. They're not that far away.
They're also not that far down because there's still light.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. If you have, like, massive underwater caverns, like, huge underwater caverns, you would get, you know, some really cool endemic species, but they would definitely all be blind.
This was one of my biggest questions watching it, is, like, how big does a body of water have to be to evolve creatures of this size? And then...
Enormous.
Like, if it's a lake, I'm thinking of, like, you know, the island phenomenon where you get, like, pygmy elephants and stuff. So that's what a lake would do, although I don't know much about fish specifically. Like, so it must be fucking massive. But then my other question is, why would you keep your city there where the thing that could
point,
eat, like, a house and still be hungry is right there?
They seem to be in a pretty shallow little lake in the swamp, so in a way they're going to be away from most of those fish, except for maybe the smaller gooberfish, which is what Jar Jar calls it in the movie. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm calling it a gooberfish.
Oh, that's why you call it a gooberfish. Okay, I missed that.
The good point, though, also is, if you remember, they bring their ship up in the middle of Naboo, like into the canal in the middle of the city, which, that's an excellent point. If you're like, don't swim, like, it's fine, like, just it's really pretty water, but please, do not go swimming in the canal.
Yeah.
Much like Venice.
So I'm assuming the Gungans have, like, murdered all the, you know, the native wildlife and that sort of
stuff.
They
would have had to.
Yeah, in that area.
But to put things in perspective to your question, Aoife, about evolving that size, these things, especially the giant amphibian, it has to be an amphibian, it's not a fish, the giant, you know, monster, that one is at least the size of, if not bigger, than a blue whale, and that is the largest vertebrate to have ever lived on this planet, and that evolved in the oceans. So, this lake system has to be big.
Right, and strong dependence on breathing oxygen. Again, like, you're exceeding limits of size from how much oxygen you can pull out of the water, which that thing is just far too big for, which we've talked about before.
And way too fast for its size, too.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think it's just connected. I mean, I think you've just got an area that's connected to the sea, and that thing swam, like, way upstream. Because, I mean, you get this with a lot of species. Like, for instance, bull sharks, you can find them way inland. So I think this is just, like, a sea monster that preys on, you know, things at the beaches and that sort of stuff. And it's just, you know, it's gotten a bit too far inland and is probably going to die there because it looks like it's going to be really hard to get out.
It's doing great.
We got to see it eat twice in the span of, like, 10 minutes. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know that it's a freshwater lake?
That's what I was about to say. I think that it would have to be because I don't think there are any saltwater adapted amphibians. But I like this theory of Sam's, of it being an invasive species, or maybe it recently came from a marine environment to the freshwater environment, because We see it take out those two fish, the polychaete and the goober fish, like back to back, and no problem. So it has no natural competitors. These other organisms clearly are not adapted to it or like aware of its presence or used to it. So it makes sense to be able to take these guys out so easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think it's invasive in the sense. I mean, you wouldn't call a bull shark that makes its, you know, way right up the, is it the Mississippi that drains into the ocean on the, yeah. So bull sharks can get right up in there. And I mean, you know, they generally go back because they, it's not a great environment for them. Like they will go there if they're desperate.
Oh, it's fine for them.
If they, but I mean, it's not like they're, you know, their number one spot. It's generally just a matter of they can't find resources anywhere else, so they have to try somewhere new. I think that's probably what's happened to this one. And I don't think that, you know,
something has gone wrong.
Yeah, I think that something has gone wrong. And I don't think it's going to find big enough prey.
I mean,
there
we ended up with, like, I think
itself.
Orcas swam up into Cork City a few years ago. Now, I don't think they lasted very long, but it could definitely happen.
And that is a symptom of something going wrong somewhat. I do think we have to imagine that they connect to the sea, because otherwise we're going to need like a planetary physicist to describe how there's so much water. Like, unless the rock is really light, and this is like the rock is lighter than the water, in which case, what is the density of this planet? And what does it all mean? How is it holding on to atmosphere?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because we don't know. Adam, we talked about this when we did Star Wars a couple of, I think it was like a couple of years back now, but we always see like this one ecosystem on a planet, and because we go to one part of the planet, and then everybody's like, oh, that's a swamp planet or a desert
planet. It's always a desert
planet. That obviously makes no sense. Yeah.
I mean,
oh no, this, don't they call that
swamp moon? It's a moon.
Yeah, Dagobah is a swamp planet. I mean, that somewhat makes sense, because not too long ago in the Earth's past, it was a very swampy, contiguous environment. Like, we didn't have a polar system. It was all a very, very warm tropical seas, swampy forest everywhere. So
yeah, but you'd still get, like, at the poles, you would still get the forests like freezing over it in the depths of winter. Yeah. You had some really cool, like, dinosaurs that were adapted to that sort of stuff.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, they would still migrate north when winter hit, but you know, they could put up with like 8 months of the year at the south or the North Pole.
Speaking of adapted, I think I've solved the giant salamander monster. I think, much like a marine iguana, it is mostly herbivorous, but it will eat meat when it can, because its teeth are not carnivore.
It does not. It's got the oddest dental arrangement.
And has that big, wide jaw, which makes sense for something that's chewing plant matter nonstop.
I was just going to think, like, if we look at dinosaurs, like, if you think of something like the titanosaurs, like, the biggest of those are all herbivores.
Because plant matter is easiest to, like, consistently get.
Or filter feeding tends to be, like, the largest aquatic organisms are those that are feeding on large amounts of smaller creatures.
Maybe this is just one really sick example of this species. Because the other thing I thought of looking at it is it almost looks like a bad reconstruction of someone guessing what an animal's body plan is. Like, some of these look like, you know, 90s dinosaurs. So maybe it's lost a lot of weight. It's starving.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what a lot of the, like, more creative illustrations of dinosaurs these days are. Just, like, putting on massive amounts of, like, fat and skin folds and, like, Brachiosaurus with, like, miniature trunks coming out and that sort of stuff. But that's the biggest of the three. The first one we get introduced to is the one we mentioned before. What's it called again? Adam, you called it the goober fish, but it's got like a name in the
field guide. Color sea killer, something like that.
OPC killer, I think. Yeah.
OPC killer, yeah. Danny, do you actually quickly want to take us through like the Star Wars field biology guide? The Star Wars biology field guide? Yep.
Oh yeah, so basically who wrote it? It's the Wildlife of Star Wars. So it's by Terrell Whitlatch and Bob Currow. And basically they've just gone through a couple of the planets that we see. So they have Tatooine, they have Naboo, they have Coruscant, and they've just done a speculative biology for the animals that we see. And then they've also added in some stuff that we don't see either at all in the films or for very long. So some of them have gotten more detail than others, but it's really, I really like it, just even from an illustrative point of view, like the drawings in it are fantastic. I think the illustrator has done a lot on creature design, so everything she's drawn looks somewhat realistic. Like, you see that a lot of thought has been put into it. And then what I thought was really cool at the end, like, they've written it as if a zoologist has written all their notes up. So at the end they have, like, you know, invasive species in Coruscant that got there because of the pet trade. And then they have a bit about how we don't know enough about Alderaan because obviously the whole planet blew up. So the only species that are still alive are the ones that were invasive elsewhere, taken for, like, food or pet purposes. So it's really cool if you're a big old animal nerd and also into Star Wars.
God, studying Alderaan biology would be awful. Like, we found these fossils, like, floating through the air, like, in the debris of the explosions.
I think there could be a miniseries in, like, a zoologist or a PhD student who is meant to start their fieldwork in Alderaan. And when they arrive, the whole thing is now destroyed. And then they get radicalized and join the rebellion. They're just really pissed off the entire time.
No, I imagine that just being a PhD student that finds themselves in the situation of being like, fuck, my grants aren't going to kick in anymore. And they're like, the rebellion, I'll join that. The rebellion. That's, yeah. I'm really passionate about the rebellion.
Yeah. So the reason I brought the field guard up is because it mentions, that the goober fish, keeps its young.
I know.
Like, the males keep the young in their mouths. Danny and Aoife, you did an episode recently on, seahorses and what constitutes true pregnancy. Would hoovering up your babies and letting them then hatch out of your mouth consist of
No.
Would that be true pregnancy in a male fish?
No, because see, what a true pregnancy involves that the young or the embryo is kind of implanted, is maybe too strong a word for what a seahorse would do, but the seahorse dad, like, protects them but also gets rid of excess waste. Mm-hmm. And so would kind of add oxygen and provide all the nutrients that the babies would need. So there's some evidence that, as well as a yolk sac, a dad seahorse can provide the babies with nutrition as well. So for something like a mouth brooder, so we see it with some cichlids and cardinal fish on reefs, they just hold the eggs there until they hatch. And then I've seen cichlids just kind of hoover up the babies when they want to move them to another spot. So they kind of hoover them up and then spit them out where they want the babies to be.
Stay there.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be true pregnancy in the sense of mammals or seahorses, I don't think.
There are two. There's another type as well, though. I think I remember you telling me about, like, an like, when you have eggs and then they hatch and you continue to, like, hold the young, or they continue to be sort of quasi-gestated, like some sharks do. That's a different kind of pregnancy, isn't it?
I know marsupials will do, where they give birth to young that aren't fully developed, but
then continue. Well, I mean, so do bears, so that's not a pregnancy either.
No.
So do humans, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are not above reproach on this matter.
No,
I was just thinking of that ovo something pregnancy I remember you telling me about before.
Oh, no, that's not. That's like they're like a shark. It's ovoviviparity, I think. So there's eggs, and then the eggs hatch inside the mother.
Okay.
And then the babies are born. But
okay.
So is there a sliding scale of pregnancy, or is it yes or no?
I don't know enough about pregnancy, to be honest.
There are, at least in reptiles, there are some instances of simultaneous oviparity and viviparity, where you have some eggs and live young being birthed at the exact same time.
That's so weird. I love it.
It's so, like, in one clutch. Like, some will be birth live and some will be...
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily something that it is adapted for, or is it going to happen a lot, but it has definitely been documented at least a few times where a snake laid eggs and live young at the same time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Holy crap.
Get you a girl who can do both.
Is that...
I think I have a question for our resident story expert.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
For this movie where they just kind of throw this planet core thing at you and show all this stuff, and then you're just done with it in, I think, 2 minutes is the length of that scene. Do you think, from a story perspective, they really should have gone more into the ecology of this world and discussing, like, what is like living here? Or do you think this was an effective way of doing it?
No, I mean, I think for me, I kind of to, I think I can't remember if it was Aoife or Danny that mentioned it. The thing that threw me when I first watched that was, why are, what's the Jar Jar species?
Gungans.
Yeah, Gungans. Why are Gungans living in this place where these like creatures that can clearly eat them are? So I think it would have been better to establish kind of like the difference between the boundaries, at least, of that, the core world versus the Gungan world. So maybe just like a bit more in depth as far as, exploring that would have made a bit more sense. Yeah. And then they just pop up in the Venice canals of Naboo.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I rewatching it, I would have absolutely loved a scene of how they exactly managed to get that horse down to the Gungan city. Because the they just had that scene where like the horse thing like rides into the Gungan city, and I was staring at it for a minute, and I was like, "How did you get all the way down here?"
The Gungan version of that: you can't lead a horse to drink, as you can lead a horse to water, but you can also force it through the water into an underwater city.
Right, or you're just driving it down in this boat, and it's just freaking its shit the entire time, and then you finally get it down there where all the walls are clear. And now it can just watch all these things floating around all side, and you're like, all right, let's watch a horse develop paranoid tendencies as it's like, I'm going to die.
Speaking of those horse things, I think that this might be covered in that Star Wars field guide, but in the battle scene where they're riding them around, those horses, those like bipedal horse things have gigantic feathers on their back, which begs the question, what fucking bird are those enormous feathers coming from?
I think it actually says it in the guide. They have a massive flying thing that I think it says it has a wingspan of 100 meters or something. And yeah, it's ridiculous. Now, they did make an attempt, I think, in the book, because they were like, this thing can pretty much only glide for short distances if it's climbed up a high cliff and thrown itself off.
Do they mean glide short distances, like fall straight down?
Yeah. I too can glide in this manner.
It's like the worst part of when you go sledding and you get to the bottom and the bird like looks back up at the top of the mountain and it's like, fuck, and it just starts climbing its way back up.
Yeah, I think they tried to do an Avatar type thing, that if there's another flying thing that Gungan warriors can domesticate and then go and steal feathers from this stupidly big, I think that's it. But yeah, they don't bring it up.
That makes you think of a bit of folklore from, I think it's the Appalachian area of North America, where you have all these mining towns that popped up during that boom that was going on there with like coal and iron and things like that. And you know, those towns they'll pop up, you'll take all the resources, and they kind of go away. And one of the ways they would explain away like accidents in towns where everyone would die or like an explosion would happen is that there was this like mountain whale thing that would basically climb up to the peak of a mountain, wrap its tail around it, and chill there. And then when it got hungry, it would like let go, slide down the mountain, eating the village, and then it would like slide up the mountain on the other side of the valley and kind of wait for it to happen again. It's like you never saw it, but that would be to explain the people dying, the town blowing up, and it being desolate.
Have they not heard of like Occam's razor? Because that's
no, Sam, obviously the mountain whale makes more sense than an accident, an industrial accident, obviously.
They didn't have TV.
Maybe that's why the Gungans built their city underwater.
Ooh, there's a story we need.
I did want to talk about the interesting coevolution that seems to be going on between the Opry hunter and the Gungans in terms of the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
That they both decided that they wanted the big sort of like extendable tongue to go on between the two. Which,
how does that help underwater?
It doesn't. And so they've just got a really cool new paper that's come out in the last couple of years looking at frog tongues and trying to figure out like how exactly they're able to stick onto different material. I don't know if you guys have looked at this.
I have not.
So they think that the saliva, as far as they've done research, which is super cool, the saliva seems to act as a non-Newtonian fluid. So basically, when the tongue is extended, the saliva, as it makes contact with force against whatever object they're at, the viscosity then increases in the fluid, which then causes the material to be sticky. But then when it's retracted back into the mouth and the frog is able to slowly pull it off the tongue, it returns to sort of like a very low viscosity. So it just has to do with the compounds and the salt that they're putting in. They're still trying to figure this out. Because the adhesive capability when it actually strikes something, they've been looking at it, is something like 50 times stronger than our average polymer adhesives. So if we can figure out exactly what they're doing to create that combination, Also, it's just a really cool idea of having something that can exist in those two different states. However, those properties don't do anything underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, when it, like, hits, like, the ship with its tongue and it's, like, pulling it back, and I was trying to look at it last night, and, like, is the tongue barbed? Also, like, how did the tongue move that quickly? Or just...
How does the fish move that quickly to begin with? It has fucking crab legs. It doesn't have, a caudal fin.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, surely they could have just, like, you think the biologically accurate solution would have been, like, sling jaw wrasse and, you know, goblin sharks, so they just throw their jaws forward and the vacuum sucks it in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also species who do, like, have, like, a kind of a little thing that they shoot out.
Right, like, you're talking about the fish-eating snail. Fish-eating snails have barbs that they can extend out, harpoons that basically they launch out with neurotoxins to stick in and then retract the fishes they're trying to eat. But they're not using a tongue mechanism. So, I mean, maybe if the tongue itself is barbed when it comes out, but I just thought it was kind of a cool area of, like, co-evolution to see, like, oh, okay, maybe there is some, like, shared ancestry that's going on here if you've both decided, or maybe it's convergent.
The Gungans also look like they're bipedal horses.
They do. There's a lot of similarity giving new phrase to that, you know, dogs looking like their owners kind of thing. We were out.
I think also Libby had a really good point from the movie itself about an interesting theory on the Gungans and their kind of genetic structure.
Oh, I was going to say, to me, and again, I'm not a scientist, I felt like the king, because it bothered me that the king looked like an entirely different species from the rest of the Gungans. And so for me, I felt like he was the queen, like the brooder. So like he's the big, reproductive one, and then all the warriors protect him.
And they say big boss. Mm-hmm. He's not gendered. I mean, I think a couple of people say he.
Do they gender Boss Nass?
Because,
I mean, I did it when I was trying to talk to Libby about this when we were watching the movie, and I think that Star Wars canon always refers to Boss Nass as he, but I don't know if Boss Nass is actually gendered.
I don't think he's gendered, and he's not gendered by the other Gungans. He's gendered by Qui-Gon, and he's gendered by Obi-Wan, but that's just typical white dude walking in and being like, oh, you're in power. You're a guy. You
know. And as we know from this movie, Qui-Gon doesn't give a fuck about what anybody thinks. Yeah, he's just going to do what he
Qui-Gon
wants.
Qui-Gon is a rebel.
A Star Wars rebels, if you will.
I will also say, because I spent a lot of my time this week in terms of doing the physiology, looking at the Gungans, because I was like, I am going to get beat out here in terms of the fish categories, so I'm just going to focus on something I can focus on. Why do they have stalked eyes?
I mean, they don't look particularly well suited for aquatic life in general.
They really don't.
The stalked eyes serve a whole bunch of purposes for underwater species like crabs and other organisms, but usually it's so they can manipulate the eyes in different directions, which you do not see the Gungans doing. And then almost contrary to that, when you see them in their full battle armor, their armor is extending to like block off and kind of stick over top of their eyes, kind of locking them in place. And I'm like, this feels like a bad idea.
Yeah. And also, like, do they... Because if they are a semi-aquatic species, surely they rely to some extent on being around water. Jar Jar spends, like, half of the movie on a desert planet with no, like, showers in sight. Yeah.
Yeah.
That bothered me so much. I was like, if you have amphibian skin, what's happening?
Which he looks like he does. It looks completely like he's got an amphibious. It's not like a toad. I mean, it could be. It could be like a toad consistency to the skin as well. But he still needs regular access to water.
He'd be burning up like a motherfucker. Like, sunburn is still a thing outside of in the animal kingdom as well, beyond just humans.
Right.
And he would be burned severely.
Yeah, never completely understood why he volunteered to go out for that desert run when, like, there's some of the people staying back in the ship. I feel like the frog guy should be like, nah, fuck you. Like, go have fun. But, like, I'm staying here.
I need
here.
A bath.
Yeah, like, yeah, right?
Because he's evil.
Because Darth Jar Jar, and he has to be there.
Moi, moi!
Jar Jar, it's Palpatine. Look, I need to apologize for manipulating you into granting me emergency powers. It was wrong, and I'm sorry.
Oh, say yes! Right, Palpy. You some manipulated me. Okay, Papi.
The side point looking like Gungan physiology in terms of they've got like a nail. They've got like a almost a duck bill that they seem to exist on. And it was like, okay, cool. Like, are they some sort of you know, vegetation consumer in terms of their history. But then when you see them moving around and talking, there's soft tissue that's on top of the bill that's like moving the entire time, defeating the entire point of why you would want to have a bill in the first place, where it's like, oh, well, I want this like strong structure I can like use a beak into. And then you see them talking and you're like, and you covered that with soft, sensitive tissue? Like, okay. It's,
and they have human teeth.
Mm, yeah.
It's like, what?
Do they?
They all have human teeth.
Oh, that's really upsetting.
Oh.
You see it on Jar Jar, and I'm pretty sure you see it on the captain who talks to Jar Jar, the only other Gungan to speak.
I think the desert, the Jar Jar existing in a desert, gives more weight to the Darth Jar Jar theory, because he's using the Force to remain moist.
Exactly.
That's why he's distracted the entire time, because he's just concentrating.
That's not the weirdest thing Force has done in canon. The Force makes a great moisturizer.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's a walking moisture form, and they're on Tatooine, so there you go.
Oh, I was just going to say, you remember that one of those early David Tennant Doctor Who episodes where, you know, it's like Lady Cassandra or something? She's just going like, moisturize me, moisturize me. It wouldn't have been more annoying than anything else he does.
Yeah.
You're not wrong. Nope. Also, the Gungans have a jointed shoulder, so they have to be arboreal at some point in their evolutionary history. And when they walk, you see this especially towards the end of the victory parade, their head moves with their legs like a bird does. So there's some kind of weird reptilian evolution going on there as well.
Could they be arboreal with underwater plant life?
Were they made in a lab?
Not necessarily. I wouldn't think in that way, because they were made in a lab.
But also, their ears, the pinna that they have, those extended long pinna. So like, it makes sense to have large ears if you're going, and they could be floppy if you're going to raise them in situations where you're trying to increase your auditory capabilities. But you see, like, Jar Jar at one point has to lift his giant ear to try and hear better. And I was like, and I was trying to find any physiological example of animals that have persistently droopy ears other than the ones that humans have bred, because we're like, they're cute. And like, we don't have anything. Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense. And maybe at one point, like, he seems to extend them. But if that's the case,
it looks like he lifts it up with some kind of muscle in the pinna itself, and he just puts his hand there to help with the hearing.
Right, but the design then doesn't make sense as to why he's having to put a hand then to try and help with the hearing if they've got these giant ears.
Well, it seems like an elephant's ear.
Right. Well, but elephant's ears are up. Again, they're lifted. They're creating a...
Maybe he's doing a social signaling thing. Like, obviously, I can hold this ear out, but I want you guys with your tiny, pitiful ears to understand. I'm like, I can't hear you.
Yeah, could it work as a form of communication, Dave?
It's just, it doesn't seem to move. And it was like, maybe, but again, so maybe that's how he's surviving the desert, is he's just using them like rabbit ears. But again, they're pushed up against his body, so they're not going to serve that purpose. And then also...
And also, he's an underwater species, so you don't need to heat regulate that way.
Except he's also in a tree. He's also arboreal.
Yes.
Could the ears not be ears, but like fins? Like when they swim?
He doesn't seem to use them when he's swimming.
Right. They just kind of, they flop along as this just non-hydrodynamic drag on his entire face and body.
He also doesn't swim like an aquatic organism would. He swims like a human does, and we're not built for the water.
I feel like this is furthering the why the fuck are Gungans under the water argument.
Well, but the only thing I could think of as to why they're under the water is going through, if they've got stalked eyes, and they've got huge ears, and they don't seem to want to be above for all that often, I wonder whether or not something was just predating the fuck out of them on land. Right, which is why they've got the eyes, they're so terrified, they've got the big ears.
Giant bird.
And they finally got to the point of, fuck this, we're living under the water, we're not designed for this, but like, Larry got eaten last week.
We're going for it.
Sarah got eaten the week before. Fuck this, fuck you, I'm building an underwater city.
I wonder, could that make sense with, because it's kind of implied, but it's not delved into in any detail, that they have some kind of animosity between the
Naboo,
people of Naboo.
They were just like, eating the Gungans.
Were the Naboo going out and just killing them? Like,
oh, the layers of racism in, like, there are layers to this.
Yeah. Hunting them for sport? Like, what was going on?
I think it's Nubian. That's what they call their spaceship. It's a Nubian design.
Or would it be Naboobian?
I like Naboobian. So I think what happened is the Naboobians, there was some kind of war back in the day where they were outcompeted because The Gungans have a jointed shoulder like we do. They must have been arboreal at some time in their ancestral history. Those big ears make sense for heat regulation on the surface. They look like terrible swimmers, but the Nabubians were better competitors somehow, and they forced them into the swamps and to live underwater. And now they have to deal with these gigantic fucking Gila monster things, gooberfish, and drowning.
And Jar Jar.
And Jar Jar.
The worst of all, Jar Jar's Jar Jar. There. They got rid of Jar Jar, so actually things are looking up.
Or he left on purpose, Dark Jar Jar.
Either way, it's good for them.
I do love the idea of an underwater city of people huddled trying to escape the Nabubians, as Adam would say. Everything's so terrible, and they get to a point, and they're like, you know, we're all limited, we're living under here, but the one thing we can't stand other than the giant monsters, fuck Jar Jar, send him to the surface, we're done with this guy.
Yeah. Here he is with Boss Nass, being like, oh, I don't know, wave. We suddenly he's a general.
Bombard general.
There's another scene where he's talking to Padme, talk, waving my hand, suddenly he's a senator.
It's a heavy burden.
Then, we see him in the Senate chamber. Talk, wave my hands. Let's not have a democracy anymore. Now there's not a democracy anymore.
Emergency powers to the Supreme Chancellor.
How does a dumb fish monster who no one's ever met or heard of make all these fantastical things happen for him?
Now, Dave and Danny and Aoife, you've all had recent experience talking about how useless seahorses are at swimming. The coloclawfish, right? What's that doing?
Undulating.
I've got one theory about the colo clawfish, and that is that it screamed so much as it was trying to find this ship and chase it. I don't think that makes sense for a hunting behavior. I think that makes sense as a mating call. I think it's real confused. I think this is what you get
ship
when
was
you
kinda sexy.
Design your ship to look a little bit like a manta ray and it moves with biological motion. Is this thing, which also has a long tail, sees that long tail in front of it. It's like, oh, damn.
Wiggle that ass, baby.
So you're suggesting this is a defensive mechanism for the ship where basically the Gungan sat down and they're like, look, if we're going to get eaten or humped, we're just going to choose the second option.
We choose humped.
Please, I just want the fish to fuck me. Don't eat me. But regarding your point, Sam, about its swimming speed, I think that it being a polychaete makes sense because the bobbit worm itself lives in burrows and it doesn't swim. Mm-hmm. It just jumps out and grabs thing and pulls it back. And they find this thing in a cave, so...
Yeah. That's the other thing, because it had that, like, kind of ribbony thing alongside it, and I was like, oh, so it could swim like a cuttlefish. And then I remember, but cuttlefish are, like, really bad swimmers as well, so that doesn't help at all.
Ooh, speaking of cephalopods, the Trade Federation people have octopus and cuttlefish eyeballs with those weird, like, W-shaped pupils.
We have to wonder, does it hunt in a similar way to, like, we talked about gharials and crocodiles? You know, does it just have a lot of speed in slamming its jaws shut, but the rest of it can't move very, like, it can maybe move very quickly for a second or two?
It's got tooth fingers as well.
Yeah, but...
What?
Tooth fingers.
It's got two arms.
The mandibles.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, tooth finger.
They almost look like chelicera. Yeah, tooth fingers.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, surely, like, they say those things have evolved to, you know, pick apart and grab their prey. But, I mean, they've got a pretty fearsome jaw already. Like, wouldn't those have been better off evolving to be fiends?
Mm-hmm. And they're not even opposable.
Yeah. But, I mean, Adam, as you're saying... Yeah, I mean, the bobbit fish and the polychaete jawed worm... Yeah, then it doesn't need to be swimming much, right? Like, this is just a one-off because it's, you know, it's a bit horny.
Yeah. The book here says the colo's underside is comprised of many fins that help propel it at quick, snake-like speeds.
I hate snake-like as a, like, unit of measurement. Yeah. Like, what does that even mean?
Also, if you look at the illustration, there is no fin here. Where is this fin on the underside?
There isn't.
So they're saying it has cilia, like a bacterium?
I guess,
yeah.
It doesn't really work all that well in the water. You kind of need those to grip onto things.
No.
And, like, what kind of snake?
It says here that if they're indiscriminately voracious, colos have been known to swallow OP hatchlings alive, which chew their way out of the clawfish, killing it. Surely behavioral ecology or behavioral evolution would teach you after a couple of generations not to eat those things?
That is intensely selected against.
Yeah.
But then I suppose the ones that are getting chewed open by the baby OPC killers aren't the ones surviving to breed. Like,
it could also be not always the case thing. It could be depending on, you know, how many young there are, what stage of development they're at.
Yeah.
But it appears to be able to eat a live, full grown one of these things, no problem. But it can get killed by swallowing one of the hatchlings alive.
I was going to say, or maybe it's another one of those behaviors that we only see when the animals are stressed and observed. Yeah, Sam always loves that story of all those people coming out and being like, when we set up cameras that were blended into the environment, we found out that praying mantis actually very infrequently eat their partner's head afterward. But when they're stressed, it happens a lot. So all of you nature photographers that had to get your camera up there to watch that, you being a voyeur led to that praying mantis's death. I hope you're happy with yourself.
Yeah.
I did not know about that. That is homicide. Kind of cool.
It turns out that just us wanting to watch for so often, the female just gets nervous during the whole thing, and she's like, I'm just going to eat my feelings.
You know when you get nervous and you decide to behead your sexual partner?
Performance anxiety.
Which, okay, now this is getting way off topic, but you know how, like, in the Kung Fu Pandaverse, there's a mantis, right? And he believes that when he settles down with a female, he will get his head eaten, right? Mm-hmm. That implies that that does happen often, which implies that whenever mantises have sex, they do it in public.
I love it.
In the Kung Fu Pandaverse, but yeah. I'll explain that to Eric when he's older. He likes those films almost as much as I do.
Yeah, that's the thing you want to focus on teaching your son when he grows up.
Yeah.
You gotta get in there.
But Master Shifu,
you're seriously afraid? Even Master Chicken's going in there, and he's a chicken. That's it. I'm going in.
Mantis, we have orders.
We need our help. Come on. I'll go high, you go low.
No, wait.
Fear the bug. All right, you little.
Hold on, buddy. I'm coming.
Into the power. Ah, it didn't work.
Mantis.
Okay. Is there anything else we need to? As if this
got a moral imperative to discuss.
Are there any story changes we can make to make this movie better? I got a dismissive face and a shake of the head. I think this movie's doomed.
I was going to ask, so for the story line of Star Wars, I am in the camp that I think George Lucas should not have listened to audience members and kept going with the Darth Jar Jar, because I think audiences would have forgiven the first episode if that had made, like, brought it around full circle. What do you guys think?
I thought you were going to say that he should have kept up with the political drama he very clearly wanted to make and just had a three-part series of, like, the camera set in the Senate as the politicians go through their various workups.
The West Wing with more amphibians, really.
When you have the opening scroll say endlessly debating, you know it's going to be a great movie.
Yeah.
Well, I just think for me, like, because he listened to it, it made the first movie pointless. Mm-hmm. Like, the whole Jar Jar character is pointless now. Whereas if he had kept not listened to audiences and kept going with that storyline, it would have given him a lot of purpose for being in that film. Yeah. Subsequently making the next two mean a lot more because there's that huge kind of plot twist. Oh.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we saw this happen with The Rise of Skywalker, where there was such a visceral and completely unnecessary hate for Kelly Marie Tran's character in The Last Jedi, and then they completely removed her from the third movie, and it's like, what was the whole point of her character then?
Exactly.
I think it just shows that, like, we were watching this one and we were like, oh wow, The Phantom Menace has a racism problem, and they have not fixed that, and they've not fixed kind of a pandering to audience problem.
That was just a lot. And weren't there complaints about the Gungans as well?
They're using Creole some of the time. Yeah. So Creole is a family of languages that happen around sort of the Caribbean and in the American South. And they're patois, and they're they're languages which happen when there are a bunch of people who don't speak a common language coming together and there is a dominant language. So they happen under slavery a lot, and they're often used, like, they're con- the Anglo-speaking world obviously has a massive problem with dialect and anything that isn't quote-unquote standard English being subpar. So, yeah, Creoles are like the Jamaican accent, I think, is the one a lot of people would think of, are considered like weird and dumb. But some of what the Gundrens are saying is Creole and Creole-esque and borrows heavily from Creole. And I think compared having that with the fact that they're amphibious and sort of like in this watery place, I'm like, were you doing it trying to do a Caribbean thing? What is it? It's really bad. It's
yeah. You mentioned Aoife and the Sea Lycanth episode, that there's a reason why like linguists who want to do a movie justice don't just take someone else's language and reuse it for a
new species. Yeah, because it's a really horrible thing to do. Like, language is an extremely important thing to people. Obviously, it's how we communicate. It's also how we identify ourselves. A lot of bilingual and multilingual people will be able to tell you that their personality is a little bit different depending on the language they speak, because there's norms and cues and etiquette all wrapped up in the culture of a language that is different. So like if I'm speaking to you in Irish, I'd be a lot less formal because it's just a less formal language. And particularly if you're going to say, like, I believe it was someone who did a language for Game of Thrones. Yeah. And it was the same thing that was said by the guy who made the Klingon language, is if a language has so few speakers left that you could plausibly just take it and use it, then that language has been really badly treated and it's been taken from people. And like, usually that's in a legacy of colonialism. So it would be a really bastardly thing to do, to just take that language and give it to a fictional race who is almost definitely going to be otherized. It's actually not dissimilar to what's happening with a lot of East Asian aesthetics in this movie, where they've taken something which belongs to a living culture, hyped it up, made it alien, like with the accents and stuff. It's the same thing. It's just a little bit. It's not treating people's cultures with respect.
Superman's gone. My stormtrooper's gone.
Your Klingon word of the day calendar's gone.
I'd say damn it in Klingon, but that wasn't until next month.
It's Kuvach.
Kuvach.
All right. Well, on that note, do we want to talk about whether or not we would recommend this film?
Guess my answer.
Yeah.
I think I would still recommend it. It's a glimpse into the universe. I like what it could have been, and there's enough fun in it to enjoy it.
I think I would still recommend it in terms of, like, if you're wanting to watch it, I have had this decision. Like, has Eric watched 4, 5, or 6 yet? So, like, New Hope and, like,
Empire Strikes Back.
The old ones. Yeah, I think he liked them, but he did not like this one.
But did you show him 4, 5, and 6, and then 1, 2, 3?
I don't
know. I think it's... I would definitely recommend, if someone had seen 4, 5, and 6, that they do go back and at least see what George Lucas thought this should be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the only context in which I would recommend this movie is as a Star Wars marathon. It's like the first time I watched it, this was before I lived here with Danny. Came over and like a bunch of us did a Star Wars marathon. And I can't remember if we did 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6.
No, I think we did 4, 5, 6, then 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. But this movie hit at about 2 a.m. like with like high on sleep deprivation, slightly drunk, having eaten nothing but crisps and chocolate for like, God,
six
no,
hours.
6 hours. And I was like, this is
living your best life.
This is the most surreal thing that's ever happened to me. And it was kind of a good movie for that context. But yesterday evening, I was stone cold sober, eating my dinner. Like, this still feels like a fever dream. So I think to give this movie its full justice, it needs to be at 2 a.m. after you've watched all three of the original trilogy back to back.
Yeah, I have to say no. I could not recommend this film. It, not because of any of the stuff we're talked about, which is all horrible, you know, from the racism to the treatment of Jake Lloyd to the all everything that we've talked about, just because it's really fucking boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, this was the first full-length Star Wars film I ever watched. I think I was 12 or 13 at the time, and we watched, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in that order. And having not much of a context for the rest of them, it was I remember having a great time that first time I watched it, because I was like, oh, this is all kind of bright and shiny, and look at all these cool creatures and beings, and like, this looks like a cool world. But my enjoyment of it has decreased at every rewatch. So,
yeah. This is the first time I couldn't get through it.
Really?
I started up again, and I think, like I mentioned earlier on, I got halfway through the Big Jewel of the Fates lightsaber battle, and I was like, I want to focus on this game of FIFA. Like, I'm just going to turn this off. Yeah.
There is one bit I would recommend.
You're going to recommend the pod racing?
Here we go.
No, it is when we see the first meeting between who I insist on referring to Orty Tooty and his beloved. I'm going to quote some quotes. C-3PO's naked, referred to as naked, and Orty Tooty's reaction to this is excited beeping. which makes C-3PO's knees go weak. This is all textual. And then does some gurgling.
Remember, in the time of COVID, cyber sex is the safest form. Yeah.
And then R2-D2 proceeds to talk about his great adventures in space, while C-3PO's like, oh, I don't know if I could do that kind of thing. And R2-D2 says, come away with me. We're meant to be focusing on Padme and Anakin meeting? Hello? This is the greatest love story of all time.
R2-D2 just sweeping C-3PO off his feet.
It's a real, like, pirate adventurer meets this, like, golden twink princess. It's beautiful.
I love it.
I would say, first of all, I am glad this movie exists, if only for the phenomenal pod racing arcade game that came from it. I would say if you're a Star Wars fan, then you kind of have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Libby, do you think you could just watch 2 and 3 and skip this one if you wanted to do like a, you know...
If you would have it my way, you would just watch Rogue One and none of the Star Wars movies.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
It's a fair point.
It's a bold statement.
I stand by it.
You were the chosen one! It was said that you would destroy the Sith, not join them! Bring balance to the Force! Not leave it in darkness!
Thank you very much, Danny and Ethan,
thanks
for coming on.
Yes.
No problem. If you want to check out the Movie Aficionados podcast, you can find it on Spotify.
Platform you can get podcasts on? Yeah.
Castbox.
We're on Apple Podcasts. I think we're on Google Play Podcasts or whatever.
Anchor.
You know, the places. Where podcasts are.
And you're at Fish Movie Pod online. Next week, we're coming back to do our all-time favorite movie parasites. Well, not all-time favorite movie parasites, but a list that Libby and Adam will have come up with to celebrate Adam's successful defense of his PhD. Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Yes. Remember, the monsters aren't real. These fish aren't fish. But the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye, bro.
Bye.
Anakin! Tell him to take off!
Will I ever see you again?
What does your heart tell you?
Are you sure about this? Trusting our fate to a boy we hardly know?
Anakin Skywalker, meet Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I sense much fear in you.
The boy is dangerous. They all sense it. Why can't you?
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.